Did you know nearly one-third of supplement consumers in the U.S. are unsatisfied with the current immune-supporting drinks on the market? Help your consumers get the products they want with Immuse, the novel, clinically researched postbiotic that activates our body's natural defenses at the cellular level for year-round immune support. Formulate with the immune health ingredients backed by 30-plus research studies. Learn more at immusehealth.com. That's Immuse, I-M-M-U-S-E, health.com.
Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in to Taste Radio Insider. I'm Ray Lateef, the editor and producer of Taste Radio, and you're listening to episode 51 of the podcast. I'm with my BevNet and Nosh colleagues, John Craven, Mike Schneider, and Beth Kaiserman. We're recording from the Taste Radio studio at BevNet headquarters in Watertown, Mass. And in this episode, we hear about a brand whose fast start took many by surprise. That's Liquid Death. Founder and CEO Mike Cesario pulls back the curtain on the heavy metal-themed water brand and explains why truly innovative ideas always sound crazy until they don't. If you like what you hear on Taste Radio Insider, please share the podcast with friends and colleagues. And, of course, we'd love it if you could review us on the Apple Podcasts app or your listening platform of choice. Beth Kaiserman, welcome to the Taste Radio studio.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Beth is a senior reporter with Nosh. You joined us on April 1st, is that correct?
That is correct.
And it's no joke.
It is no joke.
It's a serious matter.
But you only came to BevNet headquarters here in Watertown a couple weeks ago, right?
Yes, I just got here right after Labor Day.
Where were you before that?
In NYC, living in Brooklyn.
In the Brooklyn? What what neighborhood?
Bed-Stuy, right in the middle.
Bed-Stuy. Mm-hmm. What do they say? Do or die, Bed-Stuy? I'm so hip these days, you can tell.
They do say that in some parts.
In some parts. How did you get involved in this insane industry that we're in?
Insane is right. I've actually been in a bunch of different facets of the food industry, including restaurants. I started out writing restaurant reviews. Really was more interested in sort of like the health-focused nutrition side of things. So morphed into writing about alternative wellness for Forbes most recently, including obviously food and beverage there, some CBD articles coming after the Farm Bill was signed. And yeah, just sort of got involved in the natural food space that way.
Wellness and CBD sounds like you're a perfect fit for Nosh and now yeah. Taste Radio.
Yeah, seems to work out all right.
CBD, we can't.
We never talk about CBD.
Never talk about CBD.
What do those letters mean?
John and Mike, welcome back. You were only gone for a few hours, but you went up to Portland, Maine, that is, not the Oregon variety. What were you guys doing there?
First, we ate some delicious lobster rolls.
You guys go to Eventide?
No, that was crushed, and we did not have time.
Mad crushed. So it was like 10 to 12, and it was already mowed down.
We went to the High Roller Lobster something or other. I don't know. It kind of looks more like a fast foodie kind of place. I wanted to try
it. Kind of like an old school diner kind of vibe.
Pretty good.
Beth, have you been there?
No. I need to explore these areas where the seafoods are.
Yeah,
you're in Boston. We're in Boston, or at least a suburb of Boston.
Yeah.
That's close enough, right?
We have the seafood here.
Yeah.
We've got
the seafood.
Legal seafood.
Got some seas.
Legal's good.
We did a Taste Radio interview.
And who, pray tell, was this interview with?
Well, we were meeting with Alex Day, who's one of the partners and co-founders with Death & Co., which is a legendary cocktail bar, and I suppose now a little bit of a building empire of bars and consulting. So, God, we talked about a lot of things.
We talked for over an hour.
Yeah. Someone's going to have to edit that. But no, it was great. It was a great interview, though. So lots of insight into, you know, different end of the world.
Death & Co., Liquid Death. I'm murdering
my
thirst
right now.
We're just
all about death
Infinite
today.
Sessions.
It's kind of creepy here.
I got to ask, were you drinking some legit cocktails? Did you get to photograph any, John Craven, for your...
We had water.
We had water.
It was good.
The nice glassware.
Yeah, Portland, Maine water is really, really tasty.
Alex didn't make you a cocktail?
I mean, it was like lunchtime.
He's a businessman, right? He's busy.
What is this? You could have done like a throwback to the 1980s when you had a cocktail with lunch.
I mean, part of what we discussed was when he likes to have a cocktail, but you'll have to listen to the interview to find out.
I see. Okay. Well, the interview is going to be published in an upcoming episode of Taste Radio. Look for that. Beth Kaiserman, what's your favorite kind of cocktail?
I love Negronis.
Oh,
yeah.
You've come to the right place.
Hugely into Negronis. Also loved how they were kind of easy to make. I guess easy is maybe the wrong word if you're in the bar industry. But I love that it's an easy ingredient list to remember. At least that was helpful for me when I was a somewhat terrible bartender in the past.
No one's a very good bartender until they fail about 1,000 times. And then eventually they become a decent bartender.
Yeah.
Yeah. Campari is the key ingredient in Negronis, yes?
Gin.
Gin? Well, gin's the
base. It's the base spirit. I guess I'd call that the key ingredient, right?
It gets its color from Campari, the famous red color.
I like mine with mezcal.
Do you?
Yes.
I like those too. Yeah. Oh. It's a nice kick in there.
Enough of this high alcohol drinks. How about some low alcohol drinks, like the one in your hand there, Mike?
Oh, Infinite Session IPA is what I'm having my hand right now. After we've murdered our thirst, I'm bringing myself back with Infinite Session.
It was nice of the founders of said company, Infinite Session, to stop by BevNet headquarters yesterday. That's Chris and Tom Hannaway, came in all the way from the UK, London-based company. We briefly talked about Infinite Session in a previous episode. Great stuff, zero alcohol, and they are trying to make their way stateside.
Yeah, pretty interesting story. And, you know, it's one of those categories where non-alcoholic beer is just more developed in Europe. So always fun to talk to them about, you know, their efforts over here in the U.S. You know, it's definitely one of the more polished looking entries in that category here.
This is one of those where I'd love to just do some blind taste testing with people on this and say like Founders all day and see if you could figure out which one is the NA, because this is very...
That's a bold statement,
Mike. It
tastes
very much like an IPA. I mean, with alcohol. It's got soul, Ray. That usually you find the alcohol is what gives it, you know, the soul, the backbone, the malt, the hops, and the alcohol.
The malt, the hops, and the alcohol.
Yeah, that's what does it.
Those are the notes.
Well, Chris and Tom will be in Baltimore this week for Natural Products Expo East 2019. If you're listening to this episode on Friday, September 13th, when we publish this, perhaps you're also in Baltimore with us. If you are, stop by, say hi. Beth, is this your first Expo East?
First Expo East, yep. Any tips you guys can give?
Wear good shoes.
Yes.
Sneakers, for sure, yeah.
Wear good shoes.
Don't snack too much.
Study up on the crab cakes. There's a lot of different crab cakes in Baltimore.
Yeah, right on.
I'm not a huge crab cake guy myself, but I hear there's some decent
ones. There's a lot of crabs. But if you are sampling, it's good to have someone with you.
Mm-hmm.
So they can test it first. Give it about 15 minutes. They're still alive. It's good to go.
Is that why you take me along?
Yes.
I got it. I say whenever you have a chance, wash your hands, because you're obviously tasting a lot of food and shaking a lot of hands and things like that. So wash your hands as much as you can so you can prevent the dreaded conference SARS.
Yes. No one wants to come back and be ill, but it happens all the time.
It happens. It's just the thing.
Of course.
Ahead of the show, we got this week, I'm holding in my hand a container of French onion dip made with cashews and almonds. This is from a producer called Hope, known for their hummuses that are HPP'd, as in high pressure processed. Beth, have you tried these yet?
Yeah, I had a little bit of them today, actually. This one's really hearty, the French onion.
Yeah. I've never been a huge fan of cashew as a replacement for dairy, but Hope always makes great products, so I'm looking forward to trying this.
Bring it on. I love cashews.
Yeah.
Yeah, this stuff's super good. I it's like one of those products I don't know what I would do with it exactly. Mm-hmm. But having the chance to try it here, I feel like I would definitely buy it again.
I think I would take one of these from the ground up cauliflower stalks and dip it in the roasted red pepper cashew and almond dip.
We might have done that.
Yeah, that's what I was doing with it earlier.
I think I'm going to go in.
The office has just devoured these things.
They're everywhere.
Since they came in, I mean, just people... Just eating and eating and
we can't stop.
There's one in every room.
There's like a trail of them.
Yes. From the ground up.
Thank you.
From the ground up. The brand, these cauliflower, what are they called?
They're cauliflower stalks.
These are the
cauliflower stalks.
Yeah.
They're Bugles 2.0, I think. I mean, it's like that same flavor, same addictiveness, same just, but they're better for you, obviously.
Same shape as Bugles, yes. Made with cassava and cauliflower. You going to visit these guys when you're down in Baltimore there, Beth?
Yeah, I'm hoping to. I really like this product. It's nice and hearty. It has the great crunch to it. And like you said, it does hold up to actually putting into dips, which is fun too.
Indeed.
I've had a lot of their crackers before, and they have the stars. I like their products and their branding too. It makes me kind of feel like a child, because it is a lot of products that harken back to childhood, but...
They do
you know,
kind of have that playful...
Better for you vibe,
that playful
obviously.
Toy vibe on their...
Yeah. Yeah, they're really good. Really nice.
On the package.
Okay, so the cauliflower stalks are vegan. As far as we can tell, the Hope dips are vegan, but don't take our word for it because it doesn't say it on the package, strangely enough. But let's keep the vegan vibe going. We've got some vegan creamer from a brand called Picnic, P-I-C-N-I-K. This just came to the office. This is keto friendly. This is a hearty package here.
What is this, Hearty Week on on Taste Radio? How many times are we going to use that word?
25.36 fluid ounces, as in 750 milliliters of creamer. This is a lot of creamer.
That's a large creamer. That was my first reaction to it.
So much creamer.
So much creamer.
Once again, something I haven't tried, but picking up the package and looking at it, it definitely piques the interest, so to speak.
It's heavy.
It is heavy.
I think people who consume creamer like a lot of creamer in their coffee, too.
Yeah, no, it's just my observation. Too. They love creamer. They love sugar. Not to judge. I'm a person who likes to taste the coffee.
Yes, indeed.
So, a little dash of it and then move on.
Look at this. Negronis and coffee, wellness and CBD. It's no wonder that Beth was a perfect fit to come join us here at BevNet. Now, the Picnic is shelf-stable, but not shelf-stable is this Malk. Malk Organic Creamer. This is maple oat and pecan malk. Nowhere does it say milk on the package. Note that. also, haven't tried this. Actually, we saw this at Expo West 2019, and they always make great products. So I'm really excited to try this one.
I'm pretty excited to try that one. My favorite creamer right now is Primal, which we don't have on the table, but I'm excited to try that malk as that's coming now. That's a powdered creamer, the
Big
Primal.
Fans of the podcast. Yeah. Love what they're doing as well. And just to note, the malk, only 16 ounces in this one.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Last but not least, also vegan, I don't know why it wouldn't be, some iced tea from Granny Squibbs, a local brand here in the New England area. This is a product that's made in Providence, Rhode Island, or at least manufactured for the Granny Squibb company in Providence, Rhode Island. I always love this product. It looks like they did a little bit of a rebrand, a little bit of a switch in terms of what they're promoting on the front of the package.
Looks like they've done a bit of a refresh here. There's a nice color call out for the cranberry now on this Charlie's Sweetened Cranberry, which again is sweetened. That it says, you know, Charlie's Sweetened Cranberry, then Sweetened Granny Squibbs iced tea, and has a nice little sailboat on the front now.
Yeah, I thought it used to have Granny herself on the front of the can. She's on the back this time.
Yeah, she's on the back.
Yeah. The unsweetened variety, as expected, has zero calories and zero sugar. You know what else says zero calories and zero sugar? Liquid Death.
What a segue.
How about
such
that?
A pro, Ray.
That being said, let's get to our interview with Mike Cesario, who, as I mentioned at the top of the show, is the founder and CEO of Liquid Death, a canned water brand whose edgy branding and online buzz have turned more than a few heads. We first met Mike at BevNet Live summer 2018, where he participated in New Beverage Showdown 15. His presentation generated a few chuckles. Many attendees simply didn't know what to make of the brand. Less than a year later, however, it was clear that Liquid Death was no joke. The brand has attracted hundreds of thousands of followers on social media, and in May raised $1.6 million in a seed round, with funding coming from a range of investors, including Dollar Shave Club founder Michael Dubin and Twitter co-founder Biz Stone. BevNet's Brad Avery spoke with Mike about the rapid rise of Liquid Death, how his experience as an ad exec and creative director for Netflix played into the creation of the brand, why he views it as a rebuke to extreme marketing, and how the company attempts to communicate authenticity.
Hi, I'm Brad Avery with BevNet. I'm here on a call with Mike Cesario, the co-founder and CEO of Liquid Death Mountain Water, a canned water brand that promises to murder your thirst. Mike, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Brad.
So this is a curious brand, and it's an eye-raising one, and it's very much designed to be eye-raising. You have a background in marketing. Why don't you tell me a little bit about the development of Liquid Death and how this came about?
Sure. So the early days, high school, I grew up, you know, I played in a lot of bands, you know, punk bands, metal bands, you know, that kind of scene of stuff. And that's kind of where I think I got a lot of my early entrepreneurship sort of bugs, whether or not I realized that's what we were doing. But it's like, you know, we were designing T-shirts and show flyers and album covers and, you know, selling shirts and booking shows and kind of running this, your little sort of brand as a band, and, you know, didn't know exactly what I wanted to do, but ended up kind of doing the natural band job, which is becoming a designer after you realize you're not going to go tour with a band for the rest of your life. And then, you know, went to school for design, kind of switched to advertising because I was a lot more inspired by the conceptual side of marketing, more so than like the nitpicky kind of pixel pushing design stuff. Like I wanted to make funny ad campaigns and things that felt more like entertainment than design. So then I worked for a bunch of different advertising agencies over the course of about 10 years or so, and was a creative director and, you know, was running global campaigns for companies like Organic Valley and Netflix and Volkswagen and Nike and all these other brands. And, you know, I was able to learn a lot about the struggles, A, that big brands have with marketing, being in all those boardrooms and seeing where they're struggling and who's beating them and what I would see is like the short-sighted or bad decisions they would make on things, and kind of just building my own point of view on what a successful brand needs to be in the year 2019 and beyond. A couple of years ago, the first thing I actually did was I started my own spirits brand. I was only a couple years out of college, had this idea to try to make brandy cool, actually, and kind of found this white space, kind of designed this brand, made a couple calls to figure out how you can actually have it made, had basically a PDF, and I presented it to a distillery that I found up in Northern California that had been making brandy. And they were all excited, saying, "Oh my God, we've been waiting for like 20 years for someone to like make brandy cool." Had this distillery, was like, "Yeah, we'll totally make it." I had no liquor experience, none. I had no beverage experience. And I literally just went on LinkedIn and looked for liquor industry folks. And back in my hometown of Philadelphia, there was an agency there called Quaker City Mercantile that created Hendrix Gin and Sailor Jerry Rum in partnership with a big alcohol conglomerate. And once the agency guy was bought out for Sailor Jerry, he kind of didn't care as much about, you know, running an agency anymore. So a lot of the people that worked for him all kind of scattered out. And I found two of them, they were interested. They came on board and all of a sudden it's like, wow, this is going to be real. We're going to make a brandy brand. And that was kind of my first real taste into the beverage entrepreneur space. And as you can imagine, with alcohol, way, way, way more difficult than with water.
Well, that was Stephen Grass, right?
Steve Grass, yeah.
Yeah, and he has kind of a similar background to you, kind of around punk scenes. He's been on Taste Radio as well.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, no, Steve was kind of like an idol of mine, you know, when I kind of found out more about Sailor Jerry, because, you know, as you can imagine, like a lot of my friends who were in bands, you know, they were doing stuff for Sailor Jerry, and I always kind of had my eye on the brand. And once I learned about Steve, that was kind of my inspiration to be like, oh, yeah, like, why can't creative advertising people actually create brands? Like, it seems like you can make some pretty powerful stuff with it. So yeah, that was kind of my foray into it. And that brand is still around now. They're in a bunch of different states. And, you know, I kind of, at the time, you know, I was so young, I didn't know anything and didn't really get business married to the right people. We didn't always agree. And, you know, once it kind of started to get off the ground and me realizing that actually there's not going to be really any money for marketing and with alcohol, it's all about, you know, bartender acquisition and tastings and all this super tactical kind of like boots on the ground stuff that my partners are really good at. So I'm like, hey, you guys take it from here. I'm going to kind of take my piece and go back to doing the ad, you know, the advertising stuff. And I'll kind of like look on for my next thing. And then as I was thinking of my next thing, a couple years later, that's when the idea for Liquid Death came along. I knew the spirits industry and alcohol world really well from doing that for a couple years, you know. I knew so many bartenders. I knew just the whole bar game and alcohol and beer marketing game and all that stuff. And then, you know, the flip side for me was I had always been into being healthy. And what would surprise most people, I think, is that the world of punk rock and let's just call it alternative culture, there's a huge health kind of staple in that culture. You know, I became a vegetarian when I was 16 because in punk rock, there were lots of people who were vegetarians. Like that was a thing to be. There was lots of vegans. And we're talking about like the late 90s here.
Yeah, animal rights is huge.
Yeah, yeah. Long before the Whole Foods kind of surge and all that. And, you know, even at the time, there was a small segment of straight edge kind of people who didn't do drugs or drink alcohol or anything like that. The big catalyst that sparked it was, you know, I was hanging out backstage at Warped Tour with a friend's band that was on the tour. And you guys may have heard this as well, but the energy drink brand that was sponsoring the Warped Tour, they give all the bands water in the energy drink cans because they know that these brands aren't going to drink energy drinks out in the hot sun all day. So these bands are on stage pounding what looks like energy drinks to all the kids and everybody watching them, but it's really just water. And I remember thinking, like, man, that's so fucked up. Very, very sneaky. And at the same time, it was also my first time ever drinking water out of a can. And I was like, wait a second, why isn't water in cans? That was just kind of this weird question that I had, and it just sparked my curiosity, and I just started kind of going down this rabbit hole of cans and water and finding out that, you know, cans are actually the most sustainable beverage package by basically every measure, and they're infinitely recyclable, and plastic was just kind of starting to get the bad rep at that time. And then it just has accelerated rapidly the last few years. You know, it's basically plastic is becoming like the new tobacco, pretty much.
Yeah, well, let's talk about the branding a little bit. So, you know, launching a water in a can makes a ton of sense from a sustainability perspective, from a cost perspective, but you went with Liquid Death. You took a lot of influence. It seems more from metal with, you know, battle axes and blood and skulls, and turned that into a CPG brand. I came across your original video organically on Facebook, and I thought it was like a Funnier Die skit marketing the brand to start. So you started this not as a marketing exercise, but with the intention of launching a brand out of it.
Yeah, definitely. And it took a while to kind of figure out what the brand was going to be. You know, all I knew was that being around the world of punk rock and counterculture, that energy drinks owned it all. Monster owned every punk rock or metal tour, and all the skateboarders and motocross guys, and then Red Bull owned everything else in the world of sports. And I knew for a fact that none of these guys actually drink that stuff. They just take their money. They're multi-billion dollar companies that can write crazy checks to all these guys. And when you're a skateboarder or you're an extreme sports athlete, the only way you can make money is from sponsorships. You know, you don't just skate down the street and all of a sudden people throw money at you. No, you have to find ways to kind of make a living. Music is a little different because bands, they sell albums, they tour, they sell merch. They have ways of making income that don't involve sponsorship. So bands can be a little more selective about who they want to rep, which is why we've been doing a lot in the music space and it's been doing really well for us. So what we were trying to really do was just say, hey, energy drinks and beer and soda make all the coolest, funniest, boldest, counterculture-y stuff that there is. And then you look at the health space and it's nowhere even near that. Like if you took all the healthiest beverage brands and put them in one cooler, and then you took all the unhealthiest stuff and put it in the other cooler, it's almost night and day of like, oh wow, look how much more exciting and cool this, you know, unhealthy side looks than the healthy side. And that was really what it was. It wasn't so much of like, oh, we want to make this thing for metal people and punk rock people. It was more just about, I guess it's a little bit of a fuck you to the kind of extreme marketing that has kind of taken over the counterculture. It's like Monster, Red Bull, you know, Full Throttle, Bang Energy. Like it's trying so hard to be extreme, but at the end of the day, it's just marketing. Most of what is in that can is just water. There's a little bit of caffeine. There's a little bit of sugar. It's like the same stuff that's in my grandmother's breakfast tea. But all of a sudden, it's got this extreme wrapper on it. And it's just at the end of the day, it's all just marketing. It's all theater. And when we look at it that way, it's like, okay, well, if all marketing is essentially just theater because the brands between themselves are all so similar, you know, at the end of the day, how different is the liquid of Red Bull versus Monster versus Full Throttle versus whatever? And you can kind of say that for almost any brand. In 2019, marketing is about, at least for me, I think about not consumers like consumers. I think about them like investors. How are you getting people to invest in your brand? Because it goes beyond just, oh, I'm just paying this $1.85 because I only want the liquid that's in there. It's like, no, I'm giving my money to this company because I like what they do. I feel like I connect with the people that run this thing. I want to support this thing. I want to see more of this kind of thing out in the world. And I think that's how we think about it. Even though I've created this brand in a very, like you say, metal or punk kind of aesthetic, it's had this huge halo effect of people that really resonate with the brand. I can't tell you how many 35 plus women that I've talked to who are like, you know, I hate metal, but I love this brand. it's the only brand I want to drink. And we've been kind of trying to wrap our heads around, like, you know, well, what is it about that that gives it such a broad appeal, even though on the surface it seems like such a niche thing? And I think what I've been able to come up with is, I think everyone can understand that small and local and craft has been taking over big food and big drink for the last, what, 5 to 10 years. And you're seeing, you know, big beer companies acquiring all the craft breweries. You know, you're seeing everything kind of gravitating to look more local and small batch, you know, across every category. And the big brands have, you know, appropriated this kind of thing for the last few years, kind of trying to be a part of it, where if you go into a Whole Foods or you go into a supermarket, you pick up a bag of, let's say, jerky, and it looks like some farmer's market jerky, but you don't know, is that made by some huge company and it's just a packaging thing? Is this a mass-produced thing or is this a local thing? And I think most people know that. You know, when McDonald's has, quote, artisan sandwiches that are using farmer's market-looking branding, you kind of know that that design or visual language that used to instantly communicate small and not corporate isn't really effective anymore. So I think what it is in 2019, when you have 2 to 3 seconds of someone looking at your product to make a decision about it, the only way you can instantly convey this is small or this is not big or this is not corporate is you have to do and say things that big brands would never do. It's not just enough anymore to just put some handwritten type on it so it looks like it's from a farmer's market, because it just doesn't work anymore. It's too saturated. It's already been done. And I think more and more in 2019, people care a lot more about what brands are doing outside of the product itself, even down to political affiliation. Like, they want to know, do you support, you know, the right or the left? And they'll, and Nike just made that huge bet, right, with the Colin Kaepernick ad. They looked at the landscape and they said, hey, we're going to put our stake in the ground here and support this guy, where we know that there's a good portion of the country that's going to burn their Nikes, but then we know there's another good portion of the country that's going to wear Nike like a badge, like, I stand for this.
And that might also be knowing who's already buying Nike and
exactly
what
exactly
their values are.
Exactly. Especially, I think you could probably imagine that any brand that is looking to have a younger demo, it's probably going to skew that way anyway.
Mike, I heard you're starting a beverage company.
Ray, let's say I was. Do you have any suggestions for a complete partner?
Absolutely. Ingredion. Ingredion is a leading global plant-based ingredient solutions provider to the food and beverage industry, with a diverse portfolio including sweeteners and sugar reduction technologies, plant-based proteins, starches, and hydrocolloids.
Of course. Ingredion's 360 value framework delivers value according to your brand's specific needs through consumer well-being, environmental impact, and value creation. Ingredion's market research and insights for innovation can help uncover opportunities within the beverage space. For instance, figuring out what added health benefits consumers need. They have a network of technical experts that will help you solve your pain points to get you to market faster. With Ingredion, you gain a partner who helps you deliver the total beverage experience that keeps consumers coming back.
To learn more about Ingredion, head to tasteradio.com/beverage.
The New Beverage Showdown returns to BevNet Live in New York City on June 12th and 13th. Pitch your beverage startup in front of a panel of expert judges, our live audience, and viewers tuning into the live stream. To learn more, visit bevnetlive.com.
I always think of is that meme with Steve Buscemi dressed as a skateboarder saying, how do you do, fellow kids? And it always seems to be that question of marketing is, how do you communicate authenticity? And we've seen so many attempts over the years of big brands trying to communicate something similar, and the consumer sees right through it. And how did you think about that to say, look, when we do this, they need to know instantly that this is for real? And, you know, what is the thought process that goes into developing that?
I mean, that's kind of the problem that when I worked for an ad agency, that's what every big brand essentially comes to an agency for. You know, most companies and brands are started by business folks, people who are very rational minded with good reason. Like, you're trying to, you know, marketing is one part of the brand, but everything else, when you're talking about logistics, supply chain, spreadsheets, number crunching, raising money, dealing with bankers, all that kind of stuff requires a certain type of person that is not the marketing, creative, authenticity maker type of brain. So learning and seeing that, over the years, kind of helping brands, I think the biggest thing, and it sounds easy to do, but it's really not. It's really just making your brand seem like it was created by real people. And it's hard to get that done in a big brand where there's a lot of, or a big company where there's a lot of process and focus groups and, you know, boardrooms. Like, it's almost not possible in a lot of cases to create something insanely human and authentic in a boardroom, because they're just not designed to foster that kind of thinking, which is why a lot of the times they have to use an agency, because they're too close to their own product and business objectives to kind of understand what the normal person outside actually responds to or reacts to or how they think. When we talk to our customers, I really think about it like the way I would talk to my friends. I can't tell you how many brands we've tried to tell, that's really the secret to everything, is like, you know, if you're a copywriter, I mean, I remember one of my, copywriting mentors told me, you know, your job as a copywriter is to convince the person you're talking to that there's a human being writing what you're writing. That's how we approach it. We look at it like, what joke would I make with my friends? Like, how would I joke about this or comment on this if I'm literally talking to my friends on social media and I'm not a brand with a business objective? In a way, it's hard because you've got so many different things pushing the business side of, oh, we have to say this and we can't say that, and we have this objective and that objective. And it's very easy to get into this like businessy speak with your marketing that comes off that way versus being able to just talk to someone like a human being. And I think that's really the secret as well for brands, where if you look at big giant brands like Coke and Pepsi, these were brands that were literally created in the early 1900s. The name Coca-Cola was a good idea for a name in 1915, and that branding was a great idea in 1915. And of course, they've been able to become these huge, strong brands throughout so many different decades of different cultural changes and things like that. But now in like 2019, these brands are massive, and they still are massive because they're these huge machines that sort of own the whole supply chain. They've got, you know, billions and billions of dollars for marketing and all that kind of stuff. So they're still able to kind of push and have success, even though there has been a lot of decline in some of the more standard stuff that they've been doing for 100 years. But there's a time now where I think what people are looking for and what they're reacting to is very different than what worked for these brands for the last 100 years. I think you're starting to see it with brands like the Fat Jewish White Girl Rosé getting acquired by AB. It's like CPG specifically kind of has this bland, just do it the way it's been done forever from a branding standpoint kind of approach. And I'm not sure exactly why CPG has been that way. And maybe that's why a brand like Liquid Death in the world of CPG seems like, oh my God, this is so crazy and out there. But if you look at other categories of things like, or products, like let's say video games, you know, super violent, blood flying everywhere video game franchise can make billions of dollars. But when that video game comes out, it doesn't get the same scrutiny of, oh wait, how is your bloody video game gonna appeal to more people than metalheads? Because only metalheads like blood and violence. Like how are you gonna expand your audience? So it's like that question doesn't get asked there, because there's, when you start thinking about entertainment, there's, you know, horror movies that are way more, quote, metal and violent than anything we could probably show, but they still make $200 million at the box office, because there is a huge group of people that they get a kick out of a certain style of aesthetic or a certain type of entertainment. I think one fact that we've thrown around that most people don't realize, you know, The Walking Dead was the number three most popular show for women. It was like right behind This Is Us. And it's a show about flesh-eating zombies. So we think about our brand a little bit more like an entertainment company. And I think that's sort of what our vision is sort of blurring the lines between an entertainment company and a CPG brand. You know, at the end of the day, if you want repeat purchases, in our opinion, you need kind of two things. Like, one, the product itself has to be a good experience. When someone buys Liquid Death and they have an ice cold one in their hand and they crack it open and they drink it, they have to enjoy that experience. If it's like, oh, this is weird, or, you know, I hate this, or this is too hard to open, or, you know, the water tastes really funny, then yeah, you're only going to get one purchase. But if the water's good and they really like, oh, hey, this is, I actually like drinking water out of a can, or wherever they're drinking it, they have three people come up to them to ask them about it. And they start all these conversations and they realize like, oh, wow, this thing actually gets attention when I'm drinking it. Then you're going to have people that kind of invest in the brand and want to keep buying more of it. And the other part of it is, yeah, what is making people want to, you know, invest in your brand beyond just the liquid itself? Because almost any brand, I don't care what product category you're in, you can't almost ever own your liquid. Like, anybody can create a similar recipe. They can use whatever trendy little ingredient that you're putting in your thing now, that you're one of the only ones with it. 50 other million, you know, companies are going to start using it too. And then you don't have much difference between you and everybody else. And then why is someone buying you over someone else when it's not really strongly based on taste? It's not strongly based on you've got some proprietary thing that nobody else can even come close to. It is based on brand. And it's about, why do I want to give my $2 or whatever to this company that I perceive is kind of the same as the one next to it? And I think that's really where the rubber meets the road in terms of building a loyal, kind of keeps coming back fan base, is it goes far beyond just the liquid itself. It's got to be a brand that people want to support, continue to invest in. And you have to kind of keep that fire going. Like, you can't just make one funny video and that's it. You got to kind of keep evolving and making things and putting things in the world that hopefully there's enough people who say, hey, I like what this brand's doing. I want to support it.
Yeah. And, you know, I think of going back to the video game example, there's some counter reaction as well, where if the moral majority is offended by Mortal Kombat, it makes you want to go play Mortal Kombat.
Right. I mean, did you guys see the documentary with Jimmy Iovine and Dr. Dre about like Beats? They go through, you know, the history of Interscope Records and all that. They said the greatest thing that ever happened was Tipper Gore putting the parental advisory sticker on our albums. All of our album sales went through the roof. They thought they were going to like stop the sale of like gangster rap and heavy metal and all that. All it did was multiply it by 10. Because as soon as you start telling people this is bad or you shouldn't have this, you're absolutely right. Especially if you're talking to any kind of under 25 demo, it just makes people want it more.
You've taken some seed money now.
Mike, I was just in the kitchen and I saw this really cool THC-infused beverage brand called Eighth Wonder.
Ah, chill brand. They make cannabis bevs as well as beer and spirits. The product you're talking about is a super tasty cherry limeade cannabis seltzer called Lil Bit. And did you know Eighth Wonder was acquired last year by Houston's BioCity Hemp?
Yes, I did. That deal created a world-class, vertically integrated cannabis and craft beverage company. Bio's science-based processes for extracting THC from hemp have made the company the gold standard for cannabis products across Texas and beyond.
Bayou's cannabis portfolio includes 8th Wonder as well as Howdy and Beach Break, all of which are distributed throughout Texas and Louisiana.
You can learn more about all these brands at 8thWonder.com, SipHowdy.com, and SipBeachBreak.com.
On June 12th and 13th in New York City, hear from Icelandic Glacial, Lemon Perfect, GoPuff, Sachet, Diageo Ventures, and Lowe's Foods during the leading event for the beverage industry. Save on BevNet Live tickets through April 26th. Just visit BevNetLive.com.
Into the room with the investor. How do you pitch Liquid Death to an investor who maybe is trading in these all these other normal CPG brands? How do you make that pitch to say, this is something that has legs to sustain itself? It's not a one-off gimmick.
That's a good question. And I think the way we created Liquid Death is, I think, very different than the way most sort of CPG brands are formed, which was, I knew this from the beginning. I knew that putting spring water in a tall boy can that looks like beer called Liquid Death with a giant kind of dripping skull on it, there's nobody from a, you know, with a checkbook that's going to probably write you a check for that just as purely the idea. And you know, I listen to the Masters of Scale podcast a lot with Reid Hoffman. And, you know, one of his things he always says is truly innovative ideas are almost laughable at first. Because if you're doing something that almost seems like it makes a lot of sense right now, that probably means that there's 10 other companies that have already been working on it for 4 years. It's like the truly innovative things that haven't been done yet almost seem comical or crazy at first. And they're hard to find funding in the early stages. You know, like Uber. When Uber came out, it was like, people thought it was, this was crazy. Like, yeah, who's going to get in a stranger's car? Like, yeah, that, you know, that's never going to work. Or the first credit card processors on the internet. Oh, who's going to ever put their credit card information on the internet? That's crazy. You guys are crazy. So I knew that it was going to be hard. And one thing we had started doing in the agency world with some clients to try to kind of get them out of their boxes is letting the market sort of decide what's going to work or not work. Because the way it usually happens is it's like agency or company creates some campaign, or let's even say a product idea, come up with this idea, you present it to this board of people, there's three people, maybe one decision maker, based on their experience and what they know, they say, no, this one's not going to work, this one's not going to work, okay, let's go all in and invest $10 million on this idea. And then it might seem like it's a great idea to them, but then it goes into market and it fails. Or they even put it through testing. I've seen this countless times with clients where, oh yeah, you know, this campaign or this idea went through all this different, you know, fancy testing that we use, and it tested through the roof, and then you put it out in market and it totally flops. So what we started doing was trying to convince clients, hey, rather than us present you three different campaigns that you decide which one you want to buy, let's make 10 different things and find a way to test them in the market on social media, because we've got all these tools with technology at our fingertips now where, okay, this campaign is about this. So what if we made a little Google keywords ad that had a funny headline that feels like it's part of this campaign? And we'll see how many people click on that versus the funny headline that's more in line with this other campaign idea that we have. And you're actually testing it in social or on the internet to real people who are in market to kind of get a sense of what's going to work or not, because you might surprise yourself. You might think, oh, this thing is the worst idea ever, liquid death, like no one's going to like that. And then you test it in social and realize, oh my God, this thing is going, you know, bananas. But in a boardroom, you never would have been able to figure that out, or someone wouldn't have had the insight to say, oh yeah, let's make a big bet on that crazy thing. So I kind of took that approach and I said, all right, what is the least capital intensive way that we can test this idea just to see if it's even viable? Because we know that we're not going to just go immediately raise money for something like this. So let's prove it first. And I think that's something that more entrepreneurs should try to do, is rather than just kind of stick with your idea and go shop around for capital, hoping someone's just going to give it to you to take off, find some kind of way to test it in market to get some kind of read on what the public's or whoever you're talking to's reaction is going to be. So what we did was we came up with an idea for a video, which was the original video. We spent $1,500 to shoot it. You know, we had a designer create the original sort of can design on a 3D looking, you know, looked very much like a real can, but it was all Photoshop. And let's make a Facebook page, no Instagram page, no Twitter page. We'll put it on Facebook and let's just kind of pretend it's a real brand and sort of see what happens. And, you know, we maybe spent $1,000 in paid media over the course of like 3 months, just sort of pushing the video out there and a couple, you know, funny little Facebook posts of the product. And then 3 months later, the video has 3 million views. We've got more Facebook followers than Aquafina. We're getting direct messages from, hi, I work for a big non-alc distributor called Big Geyser. Can we talk to a sales representative? You know, we get another DM. Hi, I own 4 7-Elevens. How do I get this in my stores? Hey, I own a beer distributor in Utah. How can I get your product? And that was kind of what we used. Like once now we had ammunition, like, hey, look at all the views we have. Like, look how many people are following us. Like, look how many people are commenting on this saying, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen. How do I get this? How do I get this? Oh, look, distributors are actually reaching out to us, which is a rare thing. That was what we had to kind of get together as a proof point before you actually get kind of the money guys to say, oh, all right, I'm willing to kind of start taking a bet on this. And it kind of just kept going that way, where we used that to raise, you know, a very small round of sort of friends and you know, family kind of around, just to kind of produce some physical product. And then once we had physical product and it was something real that people could hold in their hands, then it became even more interesting. And then that's when we were connected with our VC incubator that we're with called Science Inc. They were the ones behind Dollar Shave Club and a few other kind of disruptive, more D2C CPG brands. But, you know, we met with them last November when we actually had physical product. We hadn't launched yet, though. We just kind of had the first round of product. They believed in it as well. You know, they saw with Dollar Shave Club the power of having a disruptive brand in a, you know, a very stale but large category and what that can do. So we kind of fit their MO pretty well. And then, we signed with them. They were able to put in a little bit more to kind of help us get our e-commerce sort of side of things buttoned up over the next few months, where we finally launched real product at the end of January in this year.
Something else that Liquid Death has done really well is on-premise and sort of using that craft beer identity to be a good non-alc solution. And in a way, it sort of rides the rise of mocktails and other types of non-alcoholic solutions in on-premise. Can you talk a little bit about that?
It's funny. It's the non-alc thing was, again, and sometimes the best things happen this way. They happen almost on accident. It wasn't something where we set out, oh, we want this to be, you know, a great non-alc solution for something. But, you know, the minute you start kind of getting your product out into the world and getting feedback on things, and you start realizing like, oh, wow, like all these, you know, we're getting so many people saying, I don't drink and this would be the greatest thing. Or I've been sober for 18 years. I've been waiting for a product like this. And we got lucky in a little bit of a sense too, that water is something that everybody drinks. There's no real like cultural baggage associated with water. Like everybody drinks it. It's, you know, it doesn't matter who you are. But the non-alc world of non-alcoholic beer and mocktails, there is definitely cultural baggage associated with it. Most men in America, I mean, I don't think you would see them going into a bar comfortably being like, let me see your mocktails list. You know, that there's something about it that feels, I don't know how to put my finger on it. Maybe it's weird that like, it's a fake something. It's like, oh, I want like a fake cocktail. I want a fake beer. And maybe there's something about that. Non-alcoholic beer is an easier thing because beer just doesn't really taste that good to most people. I mean, a couple of craft beers, you know, people get into, but we're talking about like a non-alcoholic mass market kind of beer. It's like people drink beer because they want to get drunk. They don't drink it just for the taste. So I don't really ever see just non-alcoholic beer ever becoming this huge thing because nobody really likes the taste of beer to begin with. And then the other thing that we hear from our customers is, I love Liquid Death when they're either at, you know, a house party or a bar or wherever, because they're like, it's a place that people are hanging out for 3-4 hours sometimes. And they're like, I can't drink LaCroix for 4 hours. Like I drink one LaCroix and that's kind of like all I can really drink. Like I can drink Liquid Death all night long. And I think that's been a strength for us, is it's a product that in all these different party environments, you can absolutely continue to drink for multiple hours on end pretty easily.
Before we go, one thing just real quick we didn't talk about was you built a lot of brand recognition through the Sell Your Soul campaign for a can of water. You had a lawyer draft a legally binding contract where consumers could sell their souls and receive a free can of water in exchange. My quick question for you, what are you going to do with all those souls?
It's a good question. We've had funny conversations around, okay, we own all these souls now. Like, does that change the valuation of the company? Like, what's a soul worth? you know, like, what can you do with souls? You know, it's like, technically, if we wanted, we could resell these souls on our site. Like, in our merch store, can you buy someone's soul for $2?
Ooh, or certain cans might contain a human soul in them. You don't know.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. At the end of the day, in all seriousness, it's like every company is trying to create membership programs and customer loyalty and that thing. And it's like, okay, how do you just make it more fun? You know, how do you make it more fun to talk about or do? You know, everybody's day is just filled with boring stuff all day long. You get on the subway and look at some boring subway ad. You got to go to work and you sit in your cubicle and you do this thing. It's like, how do we become this sort of fun, exciting, unique thing that happens in someone's day? Like, I guarantee you, most people who took the time to actually go and sell their soul, that was probably one of the cooler things they did that day, was sell their soul on a website to get a free case of water, whatever it is. And it's been super successful for us. Like, we started the soul program at the end of April, and we now have over 30,000 people have sold their souls.
If you join Liquid Death's loyalty program, you're in it for eternity.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, Mike, thank you so much. This has been fantastic, and loved having you on.
Thanks a lot. Yeah, I appreciate it.
That brings us to the end of episode 51 of Taste Radio Insider. Thank you so much for listening, and thanks to our guest, Mike Cesario. Please subscribe to Taste Radio Insider on the Apple Podcasts app, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or Google Play. As always, for questions, comments, ideas for future podcasts, please send us an email to ask@tasteradio.com. On behalf of the entire Taste Radio team, thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.